very longtime friend of mine, nearly 40 years now. Got a book out a couple of months ago that I've been working my way through. Her name is Irene. She is the wife of one of my closest friends from seminary. His name is Dave. I just live over in Northampton where they share a therapy practice under the name of Pathways. The title I brought it with me, the title of Irene Tompkins' book is Not Like My Mother. So here I am leading off a Mother's Day sermon with a book titled Not Like My Mother. Subtitle is Becoming a Sane Parent After Growing Up in a Crazy Family. To give these guys a plug, Irene and Dave will be here for one of our summer services on August the 10th. So I don't want to steal too much of our thunder today. So mark the date for what I know, which will be a very fine service. Like I said, having known these folks for close to 40 years. I should say the title is not primarily about Irene's mother at all, although she's in the book. Rather, it is her way, Irene's way, of giving herself something of a gentle poke in the ribs. For it refers to a desire that she had as she raised her daughters from marriage prior to her one to David to not repeat all of the perceived mistakes and inadequacies she saw in her own mother. The largely unrecognized trap she created for herself with this approach was that her benchmark for parenting being not like my mother, she sometimes missed the mark when it came to being the mother and the parent that her daughters really needed. A more universal issue behind this one story is one that challenges the readers to take a closer look at the family into which we were born and raised and how that affects, consciously or not, the families we then attempt to create ourselves. Irene's personal story is a compelling one. Contains or tells about the often abusive family situation in which she was raised and the abusive first marriage she entered into intensively to get away from the abuse in her family of origin. And I know I'm really not the best person to give an objective accounting of this book, since I've already said I've been close to both the principals in it for many years. And the two daughters she writes about here when they were little kids called me their Uncle Steve. But ego-possessed soul that I could be at times. I'm going to read the passage. This is kind of like an interlude in the book. Really, it doesn't have that much to do with the direction of the book itself, so I can get away with this part. I'm going to read the passage where she describes her wedding to Dave. As a freshly minted and newly ordained minister at the time, it was the first wedding at which I officiated. And to give this some context, Irene's first marriage wedding was in a Catholic church. On August the 21st, 1971, I walked down another aisle, only this time in a Protestant church. I was dressed in yellow, and David played his 12-string guitar while we sang a song that he had composed for our special day. His mom and dad watched from the front row as we recited vows we'd written for ourselves. We were pronounced husband and wife by one of David's seminary buddies who was performing his first wedding ceremony. Two more of his best friends read original pieces. His mother kept asking if the service was legal. While my Catholic friends thought the whole ceremony was way cool, man. But what I remember about all that, especially were the flared bell-bottom pants I was wearing at the time, my slightly elevated buckle shoes, that I am telling you, this tie. Which I actually dug out of the back of my closet, had all these peace symbols all over it. What can I say? Yeah, it didn't quite go with the decor, you know. It was my first wedding. I was all of 25 years old. I'm also aware that my wife at the time of that wedding is not my wife of today. Two other friends to whom Irene refers took part in the service. I've also seen marriages come and go. Four summers ago, the four of us, one-time seminaries, myself and two folks she refers to here and her husband, we reconnected after not being in the same place at the same time for a very long stretch of time, and now we have made it a point to spend a weekend together every summer since then. We've already got our date set for this August. When I think of some of the conversations the four of us had as we were first forming our strong friendships, back there in the late 1960s when we shared an apartment together, and the conversations we have now, something of a circle does come round. Back when we get set back from the silliness and from some of the just plain fool antics we engaged in, we did have some pretty intense discussions about what we thought the course of our lives might be, the world in which we would live in, and we talked a lot about the personal stuff we saw ourselves walking around in. Some of that personal stuff we talked about did have to do with the families in which we were raised. We talked about what we liked and what we didn't, what we could affirm, what we were going to avoid. And when we gather now, we still have some of that penchant for silliness, even though the foolish antics have been significantly tamped down. And some of our conversations now have to do with the families we've raised or had a hand in raising ourselves, what we like about what we've done, where we think we may have missed the mark, what we can affirm, what we at least hoped we could avoid. It all does come around. Well, if this is a backdrop, I'm going to take a quick run at the topic I've chosen for today, our parents, ourselves. And just as Irene uses the personal to make her larger points, I'm going to do the same. Some of you have heard parts of this story before. About my parents. My father was raised in the rural backcountry of West Virginia. His formal education went to the 8th grade. At some point in his 20s, he moved to the city, sort of city, of Charleston, West Virginia, and developed a skill as a house painter. My mother was raised in Plymouth, England. She left school to take a job about the age 14 or 15, about the same extent of my father's formal education. She met my father when he was 16 years her senior. She was 17 years old. He was a handsome petty officer in the United States Navy, stationed in Plymouth. He was 3,000 miles from his West Virginia home. They married in 1944, had their first child a year later, that would be me. And by the time my mother reached her 28th birthday, she was living in a small West Virginia town, raising four children, some 3,000 miles from her home. My father set up shop as a self-employed house painter. Sometimes business was good, other times it wasn't. They managed as best they could. When I was around 14 or 15 years old, I had a paper route and was saving my money for something that was very important to me at the time. So important, in fact, that I've forgotten what it was now. I had $20 saved up, stashed in a box in my room. My father had a real dry spell when it came to getting work. And one evening, I heard my parents talking about how they were going to try to juggle things around a little bit in order to buy the groceries that week. I'm pretty sure it was one of those conversations that a kid is not supposed to hear his parents having. Well, those days, $20 would buy about a week's worth of groceries for a family our size. So I walked into the living room and said I could loan them the money for that week's groceries. They said, no, that was okay. They'd work something out. Don't worry about it. Go to bed. I did. But then the next day, my mother told me I guess they'd had some more talk after I went to bed. They could use the money and would be able to pay me back soon. To me, it was no big deal. We needed money. I had it. I got it back a week later, put it back in the box in my room, eventually bought whatever I was saving for. I think it was in part at least because of the hard scrabble, close to the bone way my parents had to live as they were raising me and my sisters that caused my father especially to cling to the near fundamentalist religion in the way that he did. He needed a rock of certainty in a world where just taking care of the basics of his family sometimes presented him with all kinds of uncertainty. And while my mother was not raised in the same religious atmosphere as my father, she more or less, she did latch onto his faith as well, at least during the time that he was alive. My mother is now an active 82-year-old woman and has considerably broadened her horizons in recent years. I bless her for that. I also feel blessed she is still present to receive my Mother's Day call a little later today. Let that serve as a reminder. Still, some of the images I continue to carry with me from when I grew up was my father, especially when times were tough, quietly sitting in a chair in a corner of our living room and reading his Bible for whatever comfort or reassurance he could find in it. What I'm going to say next should not be taken as a political statement or a political endorsement, because it is neither. But a few weeks ago, Senator Barack Obama got himself into some political hot water by suggesting that in tough and uncertain economic times, the people most affected by them often look to whatever certainties they can grab a hold of, including their religion. For making such an observation, he was branded an elitist. Well, I don't have to be an elitist to recognize that the senator was speaking a simple truth, a truth that was revealed to me at a very young age in the family in which I was raised. On that note, I'll move on. Well, I thought on all this as I read my friend's book. Both of my parents, my father especially, saw their world through lenses of limitations and scarcity, and with an accompanying need for certitude. They needed, and they therefore saw a world, a very black and white kind of a world, in which things were decidedly right or wrong, good or bad, true or false, and not much room for any kind of ambiguity. And up to a certain age, you know, you see the world that's revealed to you largely by way of your parents, or whoever's entrusted with your upbringing. And I'm aware now that among the things I value, some of them are mirror images, just like I read shows on the front of her book here, of what was present in my family of origin. As a counterpoint to limitations and scarcity, I value the exploration of possibilities and options. I largely tend to think in terms of what can be and what I can cause to happen, rather than what is walled or restricted. And when it comes to my own search for what is true and meaningful in my world, I prefer to entertain such things as ambiguity and paradox and the open-ended question. See where it all might lead. One place it led me was to Unitarian Universalism. But I've also gained a better understanding over the years as to why my parents saw the world and perhaps had to see the world the way that they did. And times do come for me when on occasions I have to face my limitations, my lack of options. There are times when I, like all of us, need a sure port in a storm. And at those times I can appreciate the worldview my parents had, even if I cannot embrace it. When it comes to things like my wanting and attempting to be a loving and caring and respectful person, there are many positive cues I can take from my mother and my father. There are ways in which I do want to be like them, even if my world is not their world and I can't relate to it the way they did. This comes around again when I think of the influence I've had or tried to have on my own child, who is now an adult himself. I want to be a loving and caring and respectful person. I want him to be a loving, caring, and respectful person, as I believe he is. And I know he will create, he's in the process of creating, a worldview for himself that's meaningful to him, and I want him to do that, whether it reflects my way of seeing and relating to the world or not. When I do a childhood dedication naming service, as I've done here from time to time, I often use a few lines that say, "It is in the family that each person is shaped by all the interactions of thought, affection, act, and word. In the relationship of family, we receive our sense of worth, our sense of what is right and wrong, our feeling of who we are, and what our unique place in this world is." Those are very noble words. If I didn't believe them, I obviously wouldn't say them. I'm aware as well that they set a very high bar for parents, for mothers and fathers, and any others entrusted the rearing of a child. And I would say it's a bar we should strive for with the best of our energies, while being prepared as well to forgive ourselves and forgive our parents for times when they and we didn't always quite reach it. The charge I give to a mother and a father in a child dedication service is one that also, I think, applies as well to all of us as we share in this community. We should be a place where each of us receive our sense of worth and personhood, our sense of what is good and right and true, our feeling of who we are and what our unique place in this world is. For we each and all carry these needs from the moment we embark upon life until the moment we take our leave of it. It is my hope that we will continue to find among ourselves new and creative ways of living out this charge, so we may each and all, within ourselves and within this community, move to ever deeper levels of personal fulfillment and move to a deeper sense of connection and commitment to the world that needs our care.